Welcome to another episode of the FAIR Podcast. The Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing well-documented answers to criticisms of LDS doctrine, belief, and practice. To learn more about FAIR or to make donations, visit fairlds.org. I'm Blair Hodges, host of the FAIR Podcast. Questions or comments about today's episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org, or you can also join the conversation at fairblog.org. The Book of Abraham seems entirely exotic. It seems like one of the most difficult subjects to get a handle on from an academic standpoint. Hugh Nibley once complained that the book has often been overlooked.
Now, the Latter-day Saints have never realized what they have here. Neglect, I think, is an understatement as far as that goes. When the Joseph Smith papyri were found in 1967, or rather acquired by the church, they were known before that, a high authority, or a relative of my wife, in fact, who was the editor of the Deseret News at that time, said, why did Joseph Smith do that crazy thing? Why does he have to get us involved in all this Egyptian stuff? Well, why does that bother us? His idea of what was important to news was a new mall or a fashion salon open in the DCMI or something like that. Now, that's news. But why are we bothered with all this ancient stuff? In the same way, one of the general authorities was quite upset that we should pay any attention to the Book of Enoch at all. It has no point, no direction. It's not telling us anything. What's going on? Well, I say we haven't taken seriously, and that is an understatement. Contempt is a better word.
Nibley certainly did his best to get the word out regarding the Book of Abraham, but it remains a puzzle to many. Critics of Joseph Smith have pointed to the Book of Abraham as evidence of fraud, while defenders have pointed to various parallels in the text with other ancient Abrahamic lore as being marks of antiquity. Here's researcher Michael Ash in a 2004 FAIR conference presentation listing a few reasons why learning about the Book of Abraham academically can be difficult.
Well, there's several reasons. One, we have a challenging set of facts. And sometimes those facts contradict traditions or preconceived thoughts. We have a complex web of issues. And we do have an extensive bibliography of writings about the Book of Abraham, articles, papers, and books. Unfortunately, a lot of this is polemically charged. Much of the material that's available in the Book of Abraham is either written by anti-Mormons trying to prove that it's fiction, or defenders trying to, you know, prove that it's not. The stuff that is available is often difficult to find or out of print, and much of it is highly technical.
So we have some difficult primary material to dig through and a big collection of stuff people have already written about the book, and much of that stuff is polemical or argumentative and charged. Anything else?
And there seems to be at least very little that just kind of lays out the facts for people to do their own research on.
What was true in 2004 is a little less true now in 2011, thanks to Professor Brian Hodlett's brand new book, A Textual History of the Book of Abraham. Readers now have direct access to all of the known manuscripts containing the Book of Abraham text.
This is called A Textual History of the Book of Abraham, and so I'm trying to give the history of the text, the history of the narrative.
Hodlett joins us in this episode of the FAIR Podcast to talk about his new book and what it means for the current state of Book of Abraham studies. We'll be talking about Egyptian mummies, papyri, grave robbing, pyramids, prophets, scripture, revelation, archives, and scholars. It's all about the Book of Abraham on this episode of the FAIR Podcast.
Walk like an Egyptian.
Okay, the historical circumstances surrounding the discovery of the Joseph Smith papyri. Our story begins in 1798 in Egypt. Napoleon's just invaded. He's in Alexandria, to be exact, and there's treasure to be had, as Brian Hodlett describes. Talk about the historical circumstances behind the discovery of the Joseph Smith papyri.
Well, after Napoleon goes into Alexandria in 1798... there's an influx of, I guess what we might call scientists, I suppose, for that day anyway. People, artisans, scientists, skilled laborers, those kinds of things. They knew, of course, when they went into the area that they were going to find stuff. It was obvious. I mean, they could see the pyramids up in Cairo. But the really interesting thing that happened with this influx of people is that the rate of plundering absolutely skyrockets at that point. And so Egypt is really plundered to the point where even today they would like to get their stuff back from some of these museums. They'd like to get the Rosetta Stone back from the British Museum. They'd like to get some of their stuff back from the Louvre in Paris. And it still bothers them that much. At the same time, you've got all these discoveries happening. You've also got a kind of an underlying black market going on where people are making money off of this stuff. Kind of like what happened with the Dead Sea Scrolls, of course, before somebody was able to try and figure out a way to get this material back into somebody's hands that had some sanity and responsibility and wasn't in it just for the money. And that really helped to kind of lay some groundwork for future discoveries. So Labolo, Antonio Labolo, who worked for a guy named Drovetti, I think it was funded by Drovetti and some others, went in and with a sidearm and goes into the area and digs around to figure out what they can get so that they can make money. It was a money-making venture, of course. And so they go down to the Valley of the Kings. Of course, the Valley of the Kings is on the west side of the Nile, the side of death where all the tombs are, and on the east side, of course, are the temples. So they knew kind of that they should go over to this other side over here and see if they could find some riches in these tombs.
This is where King Tut was found in
this. This is exactly where King Tut was found, yes. So they go into these areas and start digging. And then they'll find these big caverns, cavernous tomb areas. And they'll go inside these. And they discovered quite a few. There were a few that were discovered before Labolo, and certainly some were discovered after Labolo. But in Labolo's time, you can see that he went and dug out several areas. In one of the tombs, he put his name up on the lintel. Or you can find his name over in the Ramesseum. He's got his name up on a column there. He just engraved it right in the column. Oh. And it's Drovetti, 1820, something like that. I took it when I went out in 2004 with a bunch of BYU students out there. I had them hunt around, and we found it up on the... It had been found before. We refound it again because I couldn't remember where exactly they said it was. So I just put the students on it. We found it. But when Drovetti goes into these tombs, he's of course looking for riches. So they're walking all over these mummies, you know, they don't care. They're just, you're crunching, these crunching sounds under your feet. Because when people were entombed in those days, many times they'd entomb all of their servants and everybody else, and they would just be lying all around. Then you'd get into the most inner part of the tomb, and that would be where the main person was, the VIP, and then that's where the riches would be, of course, and all that, and that's what happened with King Tut. But you've got lots of mummies all along the way, and they're just, you know, sloshing over these, you know, dust kicking up, I'm sure, all over the place. So, in one of these caves, though, or one of these tombs, he found, again, hundreds of mummies, but he was able to extract 11 mummies out of that tomb. Now, we don't know exactly what tomb it is. We're still not sure. John Gee has an idea of several tombs, but we've never been able to really go back and investigate some of those potential tombs that we think... in the 60s, there was Pit Tomb 32 or 33... that somebody had said, yeah, that's the one. But we found out that one there was already opened up before Labolo got there, and so it's probably not that one. And we're probably going to be able to find it someday. Maybe with this new Egyptian uprising, they'll get some new bureaucrats in there that'll let us in there now. I don't know. Zahi Hawass, it was the Supreme Antiquities Council over there, is really hard to work with in terms of letting Americans come over there. And
well, look what we did last time, right?
That's exactly right. They're probably not that happy with us coming after what the British did and the French did and that kind of thing. So, but that's where those 11 mummies were found, in a pit tomb down in the Valley of the Kings area.
And how did they get from an Italian guy in Egypt to Joseph Smith in New York, or Kirtland, I guess?
Yeah, when the mummies themselves were taken out, extracted out, they were taken to Italy. That's where Labolo is from, of course, Castellamonte, Italy. And from there, he had them shipped to New York, we think. We know that there's some shipping receipts and such that get it to New York, but this is where it gets interesting. It used to be thought that Michael Chandler was in New York picking them up and then going off and doing his little traveling show, you know, charging money for that. Well, Brian Smith has got some new research. He's found out that there is no evidence of a Michael Chandler up in the Northeast there at that time period. And he's not even sure when Michael Chandler connects with these mummies. So we're not sure exactly who picks up the mummies and how Chandler gets them. Brian Smith also has the mummies traveling down to New Orleans and then back up again.
Are they on display? What are
they
doing
with
them?
Yeah, he displays them. He charges people a certain amount of money to come and view these mummies, and everybody was kind of excited about it at those times. It was all these Egyptian remnants and mysterious things, and people are in awe of it all. And so he makes his way into Kirtland, of course. The story has been that he heard about Joseph Smith while he was up in New York or up in that area somewhere, and that he heard about it. Again, we haven't been able to pinpoint him there, so we don't know if that's for sure or not. That's Oliver Cowdery's story, but we haven't been able to verify it yet. Not to say that Oliver didn't tell the truth, we just don't.
He's just the only source we have that talks
right.
about
it. It would be nice if we had some other documentary right. evidence on that one. So I'm okay to take Oliver, you know, and go with that for now until we figure out some more. But if he did hear about it up there and then he brings him down into Kirtland, that would be the connection there with Joseph Smith. He comes into Kirtland end of June, very beginning of July or something like that, and calls for Joseph Smith. And Joseph Smith meets up with him and they talk about it. And Joseph Smith wants to take the documents with him. And I think he allows him to do it for a little while, a few days or whatever, and he comes back and says, yeah, I'd like to have these. And Chandler says, well, what do you want? And he says, I'd like to have these rolls. Chandler says, well, they're a package deal. I'm sorry, but I don't want these. He had sold a few along the way, and he got it down to four, and I guess he just didn't want them anymore. He was tired of them, I suppose, carting them around, I guess. I don't know. And maybe he had enough money at that time. Actually, Chandler stays down in that area for the rest of his life, so he doesn't actually move anywhere far away from that central area down. I don't think it was right in Kirtland, but it was somewhere out in the area not far from there. So that's how we get the materials to Joseph Smith, of course. And Joseph Smith's first declaration or his first comments.
This is in 1835.
This is all in 1835, June, July of 1835. His first statement is, we've figured out that these are of a record of Abraham and of Joseph. And that's all we really hear. You know, the records on July of 1835, from July of 1835 to September 1835, are pretty silent. We're only relying on W.W. Phelps, who goes into Nauvoo and writes some stuff for that period and then inserts it into the record. And so it's actually later stuff.
History of the Church that talks about it was written, I think, in 1843.
That's right.
That's remembering what happened in 1835.
Exactly. So we're hoping that he remembers correctly what's going on there, because it is a few years later, obviously. So
now immediately we bump into a problem there with Joseph is saying, here's a book of Abraham. And people point out the line, you know, written by his own hand on papyrus. Now, when you date that papyrus, it dates from what period?
Dates to the Ptolemaic period, probably about between 1 and 200 B.C.
Okay, so in a historical Abraham would have been much before that.
Sure.
So how does that connect up?
Yeah, it's certainly not an autograph copy of the manuscripts there. And I don't know exactly what Joseph Smith meant. He may have meant that this is in the hand of Abraham in terms of transmission. He may have understood that. I don't know.
Do you think he also might have thought that it was an autograph?
It is possible. It's possible that he could have thought it was an autograph. You know, the Lord doesn't correct us on every little thing, every little error we believe. And so it is possible, certainly. Understanding that statement, which, by the way, was taken out of if you go through the book, you'll notice that it gets taken out later on, that it just caused some, I guess, confusion. So, when he says written by the hand of Abraham or something like that, if he believed it, he was wrong. Simple as that.
I think Nibley hypothesized that was a way of introducing an actual text. Is that a plausibility now, or is that sort of an outdated idea?
I haven't really seen that so much anymore. I've seen it in terms of transmission, where something is transmitted down a long period of time, and you can still say it's in the hand of that person. I've heard that before.
So Joseph has these papyri, and he says these are the writings of Abraham. We're going to start translating these. And then the dates get a little murky. We're following a couple of journal accounts and a couple of reminiscences from a few years later of the dates of when this was going on. But anyway, he's producing this text. Now, that's what your book focuses on, is the actual textual output of those translation encounters, not the actual papyri.
No.
And that sort of thing.
No, Mike Rhodes deals with the papyri. He's the one that, in fact, there's another volume out, as you know, that he has, and he's dealing with all of that. And I'm just dealing with the actual narrative itself.
Okay, let's take a quick break to give a bit of background for what comes next in our interview with Brian Hoglund. We've just heard about how the papyri got from Egypt to Joseph Smith. Next, we'll talk about what Joseph Smith did with the papyri. There are essentially two different types of documents we're going to be talking about. Think of them as the old and the new. The old type is the Joseph Smith papyri themselves, the actual ancient documents from the Ptolemaic period. Unfortunately, we no longer have all the papyri Joseph had in his possession, and there are disagreements over how much of the original we actually have. The new documents were created by Joseph Smith and various scribes between 1835 and the early 1840s. These documents are collectively referred to as the Kirtland Egyptian Papers. The problem is that much of the Kirtland Egyptian Papers lack context. In other words, the people putting them together didn't actually describe exactly what they were doing. So we have to infer from the documents themselves. We typically divide these new documents into two types or categories. First, there's the Egyptian alphabet and grammar manuscripts, which look like attempts to decipher the Egyptian language. And then second is the actual Book of Abraham manuscripts, which contain flowing handwriting of the actual text of the Book of Abraham. And then in the left-hand margin, there are Egyptian symbols, which are also found on some of the JSP. So to recap, we have the old stuff, the Joseph Smith papyri, and the new stuff, the Kirtland Egyptian Papers. The Kirtland Egyptian Papers includes two types of documents. First, what looks like an attempt to decipher Egyptian, the so-called Egyptian alphabet and grammar. And second, actual transcripts of parts of the Book of Abraham. Hoglund's new book deals almost entirely with these actual transcripts of the Book of Abraham text. His next project is going to include the Egyptian alphabet and grammar. So with that bit of background, let's get back to Hoglund. Now, what was your main hope for this, to put this book out? It's part of a series.
Yes.
Other books. What was this one intended to do?
This book is intended to do a couple of things. First of all, to get the photos out, obviously. I wanted to get the photos and the transcripts out so that everybody had those in their hands and that the church is not trying to hide things, that they're just as interested in getting those out as I was, and they have been just, you know, really good to work with in terms of getting this material to the people.
Is there a reason you did color in the back and black and white earlier?
Money. Pretty much money. If you do color every single...
This whole page would have to be... The whole sheet would have to be... Okay, I got
exactly,
you.
Yeah. And it would affect the price again of the book. So I felt like it's probably okay just to use the black and white ones with just the... Uh-huh. And then you can go back and check things against the color one if you need to. That kind of a thing.
Right. And so that's good.
Yeah, so that was one of the main ideas. The other thing that I wanted to try and do... This is called a textual history of the Book of Abraham. And so I'm trying to give the history of the text, the history of the narrative. So, of course, we're going to talk a little bit about translation, and then we're going to show how the text changes over time from the manuscript stage, of course, using the times and seasons as my base text, and then going all the way up to today. And I wanted to have a very detailed record of those changes so that if a person wants to read, go through and study the changes in the text, they can look at these different variant readings and argue whatever they want from that point. It's a source. It's basically a source book.
How long has this book been in the making then?
Probably for 6 years.
How did the idea come about?
It was based on the previous works that have been done by
Let's see, who do we have? We have Jackson, you know, working on the JST. We have Skousen working on the Book of Mormon. We have, of course, Jackson working on the Book of Moses. And there were several of us that thought, you know, something needs to be done on the Book of Abraham, too.
So you're seeing all these original texts coming out in
absolutely
the Book of Abraham.
But you know who one of the first, really, that started kind of really looking at things was John Twetness. He's the one that produced the first, I guess, critical text. But it was, so he was one of the first ones. It was supposed to start out as just a pure critical text. And then it kind of expanded into, well, let's do something with the manuscripts, too. Let's put in the transcriptions. We might as well put that in. And so it kind of blossomed into this a little bit bigger thing than just the critical text part.
Yeah, so you put it into a family of texts where we're trying to get back to some of the most early versions of these scriptures.
That's exactly right.
What's the import of those, of making those available?
Well, this is a source book, and so if a person uses the critical text, if you want to call it that, that's fine, but it's not really a true critical text, because a true critical text is going to try and argue for an original reading, and I don't do that. I present all of the readings, and I log all those readings, so that a person can go back and argue for a variant if they want, and I didn't... You know, if I were to do that, actually, this book wouldn't come out for probably another, you know, 5 to 8 years if I were to go through and discuss every single little variant in there.
What's your background academically?
Well, my background is in Arabic and Islamic studies. I know that sounds like a far cry from anything we're talking about here, but it actually does kind of play in. I mean, I'm still into text, still into, you know, trying to figure out... you know, how texts relate to each other, those kinds of things. And I did that in my Arabic and Islamic studies materials. And I have used my Arabic and Islamic stuff with the traditions book, as you know, because I did lots of translations and such from the Arabic to English. And so Abraham and I have been meeting each other on the Arabic level already before this
project. He plays a big role in Islam. So.
Oh, he does. Yeah. Big, huge figures in Islam. So... So what got me interested in this? I think it was the desire again to try and get this stuff out. I just felt so strongly about it. I guess I can't underscore enough how important it is that when you have the material out there in fragmentary form like we do right now, in a sense, with somebody like Brent Metcalf, who has all the photos, but only lets certain pieces of it be seen, mm-hmm. and maybe a few people out there, that it just, to me, it was just so important. This is a important topic. I mean, most Latter-day Saints know that this book here doesn't make or break our testimonies. I mean, that's not really, you know, it's not really a problem with that. It's an area of study that we've been, I think, handicapped with, though, because we don't have the material. We don't have it in our hands. And we're still a little bit handicapped because I don't have the Egyptian stuff out yet. And so I want all of that out eventually. And so within the next couple of years, you're going to see another book come out, and then you're going to have all of it in two volumes with every bit of material that's up there in that little cardboard box up there. And it's going to be all there. It's going to be three books because you've got Rhodes' stuff, remember.
Okay, so. He did actual translation. So he did it from a strictly Egyptological perspective,
that's right.
Just something that could be used by anybody.
Exactly.
Even non-Latter-day Saint. This is just what a contemporary Egyptologist would say.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so this book is, to me, it's a start. That's all it is. It doesn't have all the answers yet. I'm hoping that somebody comes up with the answers.
Let's talk about the sources that you have then.
Okay.
We have basically manuscripts that have been written with the text of the Book of Abraham in them. How many manuscripts do we have?
We have three 1835 manuscripts, and we have one main manuscript from 1842, Nauvoo period. Those four manuscripts cover roughly Abraham 1:1 to Abraham 2:18, those four manuscripts. Then there's a couple of manuscripts on the facsimiles, too. Now, those manuscripts come out of Nauvoo period as well. And
do you think Joseph did work on the facsimiles prior to that time?
You know, that's a good question. That is a good question.
Is there any evidence pointing to that? Or
there is in some of the Egyptian papers. Some of the material that's in those Egyptian papers goes back to the 1835 period, I think. And you've got Kolob being talked about just like you do in the facsimile 2 explanation. And so my guess is that there was some work done on the facsimiles earlier. But we don't have any evidence for that other than just some of those little statements that we find. We have nothing that tells us, you know, that he was working on facsimile number 1 or a vignette or whatever they might have called it back in those days. There's nothing like that. And so we can only kind of take a shot in the dark. And when you get to 1842, you know you're working on it, obviously. And really, it could be the first time that he's actually putting it together. It could be the first time where he's saying, okay, let's number these out now. Okay, let's call this one facsimile number 1, facsimile number whatever. And let's number out some explanations. And maybe he culls together some things that he's worked on before.
That's a pretty big, considering the span of Joseph Smith's presidency, if we want to call it that, that seems to be a pretty big gap between when he began in 1835 and then when he got back to it in 42 in Nauvoo. What do you make of that gap in time?
Yeah, I've thought a lot about that. And I think when I look at 1835, 1836, when they're working on the Book of Abraham, we've got all these translation periods that we'll probably end up talking about in a few minutes, and you get all this work happening, and then right around, you know, beginning of 1836, you've got the Hebrew school, of course, with Rabbi Satius, and you get some of that going on, and then we start, you know, not long after that, we lose Warren Parrish, he apostatizes.
He was a scribe.
That's right, he was an important scribe. He was up till about May of 1836, and we lose him. And then things start unraveling in Joseph Smith's whole life. I mean, people are apostatizing, and of course, leading up to the big 1838 dark period there.
In Kirtland,
losing the bank, losing... I just think that there must have been so much going on that he just was never able really to get to it during that time period, because we have nothing that comes out of... Our earliest is 1835. Then we don't have anything. I guess we could, if somebody wanted to try and date these manuscripts, I suppose you could push it into the beginning of 1836 if you really wanted to. But really, that's about as far as you could go with them. After that, there's nothing until 1842. And then you get these other manuscripts coming out. And then you get the printing, of course, in the Times and Seasons. But nothing in between there. It's a huge gap. And I just think that Joseph Smith must have been so enmeshed in all of the problems that he had to deal with that he just... And then once he became editor of the Times and Season, I think that helped to kind of speed things ahead a little bit.
You bring a new designation in. You call it AB0. It's basically a hypothetical precursor to the manuscripts that we have now. The manuscripts we have now, you believe, are copies rather than being dictated. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The dictated copies of manuscripts that we have that come from Joseph Smith exhibit certain characteristics, such as run-on sentences, no punctuation, and no paragraphing, no structure to them at all. Like the Book of Mormon manuscripts. And even with some of the letters that Joseph Smith had, we can find some of the dictated materials from that, and it's still kind of the same way, and then they go back later and kind of fix it up. And so there's always there's always an eye on getting the edited version out, but Joseph Smith wants to get his thoughts down first, and then we'll work on the editing later. And as far as I can tell from these manuscripts, they all exhibit paragraphing, certain structure to them, punctuation, you know, the name spelling is a little odd in terms of some of the spellings between names are different from each other, but that may not by itself, of course, indicate copying. But it just seems that when Joseph Smith wanted to get information out, he would receive dictation, or he would give dictation after receiving his revelation, have it written out, and then he would allow others to copy that material. It looks like these manuscripts are just a little bit down the road in terms of editing from that very first one. And because it's already started, like the very earliest manuscript in this one, it looks like somebody had already gone back and done some editing markings on there, maybe with the idea of getting it printed someday, which was Joseph Smith's concern. But even without the printing, Joseph Smith was still, let's make copies of this stuff. Let's get it out to the saints. He was always concerned that when he got a revelation, that he wanted to make sure that he could get that circulating out there as soon as he could. And so he would allow copies to be made. That would explain why we have more than one copy of certain sections of the manuscript, like Abraham 1 through 2:18. It also has implications on translation, which I'm sure we'll get to in a few minutes. But as far as the dictation, I've put AB0 in there because, as far as I can see, all of these manuscripts are derivative, that they come from an earlier manuscript.
Now, we also have other manuscripts that aren't included in this volume that I believe are in the process of being published, and that's some of the Kirtland Egyptian papers.
Yes.
Have you seen any evidence that those could be AB0, that those could be related to AB0, or that perhaps those were earlier than the later manuscripts? Perhaps they were. Some people would say, "Oh, this represents him trying to show he's translating. Joseph Smith's trying to show he's translating." What's your answer to that perspective?
That's a very good question. And when you talk about these Egyptian papers, you have to keep a couple of things in mind. Number one, the characters on the Abraham manuscripts that I'm dealing with in this book do not associate with characters in the Egyptian papers. There's only a couple of characters in the earliest manuscript that I dub AB1 in the handwriting of W.W. Phelps that has a couple of characters that you can find in some of this Egyptian stuff, but all the rest of the characters are not in those Egyptian papers. Now, they are on the papyri. You can find them on Joseph Smith Papyri 11, and then you can go down there's a couple of lines that you can just go right down that line, and you can find those characters. And so they don't match up that way. They're not connected to those papers directly that way, except for that one document by W.W. Phelps. And that one, I'm still trying to figure out as well how that connects. Now, as far as the Egyptian papers coming before or after the Abraham translation material, it looks to me that these Egyptian papers are so scant in terms of offering grammatical language scheme that would be able to give a language that would be able to give meaning to a narrative. And I haven't been able to go from that direction to a narrative yet. Now, I have looked at it from the narrative direction back to the Egyptian papers, and I have found that there's some things that you can do there. I found some, you probably looked in the book, and you can see that there's some connections there between the Book of Abraham and some of these Egyptian papers as far as the narrative goes. But I haven't been able to figure out how they would go from just having the Egyptian papers to creating the Book of Abraham. I haven't been able to figure out how they would do that yet. Even with the grammar and alphabet, which is the longest, the biggest document, it's probably, 30 pages, 30-something pages, and I haven't been able to make it work yet. And so it looks to me, at least as far as the evidence suggests, that the Book of Abraham narrative was already there, and that these Egyptian papers are derivative of that again. That's the best I've been able to do so far. Now, there may be some new evidence that comes up that blows all that out of the water, and someday we'll have to rethink all that, but as far as I can tell right now, I can't see how you can get a narrative to the extent that we've got it from those Egyptian papers. So, in July, we really have no overt, I guess, record of the brethren saying, we this day translated the Book of Abraham. In July, they're talking about the Egyptian stuff, an Egyptian alphabet or something like that. That's what W.W. Phelps seems to be remembering here, is that Egyptian stuff. So it's possible that it was still done in that month. I mean, we do know that Joseph Smith said, I hired W.W. Phelps and Oliver Cowdery to help me, to scribe for me on the Book of Abraham.
It's unusual because we don't have anything in Cowdery's hand, right?
Nothing.
So there's got to be some other stuff that we don't have.
Exactly. That's my point in the book.
In fact, we know there is, right? There's actual Book of Abraham text that we have printed now that we don't have any manuscripts for,
that's,
right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, Abraham 3, part of that we don't have in manuscript form, and we don't have anything in Abraham 4 and 5 in manuscript form.
What do you think happened to that? Just lost that's, along the way?
I think so.
Of time?
I guess so. I have no idea. I'm hoping that someday somebody's digging around up in their attic or whatever, and they find it, and then they give it to me, and then they say, here you go.
And that's probably one of the reasons I assume you use the Times and Seasons publication as sort of your home base, I guess we could call it. The book is structured around the Times and Seasons publication of the Book of Abraham. Why did you choose to do it that way?
Well, because I didn't have the luxury that Skousen has with a nice printer's manuscript and a full printer's manuscript, actually, for the Book of Mormon, and then about one-third of the Book of Mormon in original dictated manuscript. And he's able to do a really good study there to figure out what is a Joseph Smith intended here. My first real connection with Joseph Smith doesn't really, I mean, obviously the text comes from Joseph Smith, but his hand's not on it. I can't find any of his writing on it. I've got a little bit of Joseph Smith with the Egyptian alphabet document, and that's about it. But nothing in the narrative itself is in his handwriting. I can't figure any of it out as his stuff. I do know that Joe Smith becomes the editor, and he personally takes responsibility to make sure that the Book of Abraham gets out in 1842. So he supervises that himself, personally. And so he's working with Wilford Woodruff, of course, and some of the other brethren. Willard Richards is helping out. He's scribing for him. And so my feeling is that text, that Times and Seasons text is the best that represents Joseph Smith's intentions. And otherwise, if I was going to do a partial study just based on the manuscripts, I would be limited to Abraham 1:1 to 2:18 and a little bit in Abraham 3, and that would be about it. There wouldn't be much to go on there. And so I went ahead and chose the Times and Seasons, and then still had the manuscripts in there, of course, and referred to them in the manuscripts and referred to variant readings that you're going to get in the manuscripts. But my feeling is, well, once you get to the Times and Seasons, Joseph Smith is thinking about it in this particular way. And so we're going to go along with that. And then, of course, after that, it changes. And we'll talk a little bit more about that, I hope, because there's some things that happen later on with the text. But as far as the Joseph Smith period, that's the best I've been able to do, is to and so it's the very first publication.
Okay, so Joseph Smith sits down, he's got his scribes, he's got his papyri, and then we have very few specific reminiscences of how the actual translation process went, which is the same, by the way, with the Book of Mormon. And we have a statement from John Whitmer, who said the book was written, here's the quote here, it was written by the revelation of Jesus Christ that Joseph Smith could translate these records. Wilford Woodruff mentioned the Urim and Thummim being used, and Lucy Mack Smith, the mother of Joseph Smith, talked about a translation process that is maybe familiar to people who have learned more about the Book of Mormon translation, which is Joseph using his hat and probably a seer stone in that hat and looking in there to do the translation. So none of them describe him with the papyri rolled out and him looking at it and then just how you might think a translation would go. Is that
that's my sense too. I've never really seen anything that specifically says something like that, that it's all rolled out now. Joseph Smith is now going character by character, right, translating the Book of Abraham. We never get that kind of a explanation for it.
The closest thing to it is probably the manuscript evidence, where you've got the early transcripts, and they have Egyptian hieroglyphs in the margins, and then Book of Abraham text next to that. You've got one hieroglyph and then a whole block of text.
That's right.
And subsequent critics have looked at that and said, you know, here's Joseph Smith. He was saying that all of these words went with this one hieroglyph, you know, that which is, you know, it can't
seems like an awful lot to yeah. swallow there. But, you know, there are indications that people thought, in a mystical sense, that you could get a lot out of one little character, even back in those days. And I don't know what they were thinking exactly. When I look at those characters, I do look at the papyri, and I can see that they're kind of going down the line there, taking each character, putting it on the piece of paper, and then putting some text there. And now, whether or not they thought it was a translation, or if, you know, Nibley's idea, of course, was that it was kind of a reverse translation, mm-hmm. that the scribes are trying to figure it out. Joe Smith already had the narrative there, but now they're going back and trying to see if they can connect things. And, of course, that doesn't go over well at all with the critics. They don't like that. Because to them, it's kind of Occam's razor. I mean, it's the simplest explanation.
Seems like an ad hoc approach to it. I mean, it's possible, but it...
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't go with Joseph Smith's usual way of translation. Just like you said, he's got the hat there with the Book of Mormon. Yeah. The Book of Mormon's plates are just sitting...
are away from him. He's not studying them like
that's
a book.
Right. Yeah. So there is the idea that that maybe these papyri were a catalyst for him. And that he did receive revelation, as Whitmer says there, direct revelation, and then you're getting the kind of like the DNC 7 thing, you know, with John's writings. Maybe it's like that, and that doesn't really bother me, other than the fact that you wonder, why would the Lord do that? And if Joseph Smith is thinking that he's getting it off the papyri, which, you know, that's debatable in and of itself, but why would he let him think that?
Right.
That's kind of the idiot prophet model there, and that bothers a lot of people. But the fact that Joseph Smith received catalytic revelation is well established in our literature. There's just no question about it. Think of DNC 77. I mean, every big thing that we get there, it's kind of a catalytic event, you know, where suddenly, poof, he gets these big, huge revelations.
Right, they're looking at the Book of John, and then him and Sidney Rigdon have a vision of the 3 degrees of glory.
Exactly.
Or they're talking about whether John the Revelator died, and he looks in the seer stone and sees this parchment of John.
Exactly.
So that sort of a thing.
So,
or the plates being away from them when he's translating the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, yeah. He's not even looking at the plates there. He's just reading the stone, apparently.
Right. So we've got theories versus what the evidence says, and some of the theories then would include that Joseph Smith is literally translating just the Egyptian right off the actual papyri.
That's right.
And right onto his, dictating it right off the papyri. Then we've got the idea that Joseph Smith is inspired as he's working with the papyri to reveal this text of Abraham that wasn't necessarily on that papyri, but it came through revelation.
That's right.
Which was prompted by his use of the papyri. Any other? There's one, Joseph Smith just making it up, or
yeah, certainly that one's
so
there,
and that one
kind of goes in line with the critic's idea of here you got your
one
character.
Symbol and the paragraph.
That's right, and that's Joseph Smith making it up there. Of course,
has anybody else proposed anything other?
Yeah,
than
John Gee has proposed that there is an actual role, or an actual part of a roll, whatever, that has the Book of Abraham on it, and that Joseph Smith was working off an actual text. And he kind of goes with the Joseph F. Smith reminiscence of, I think it was at the Mansion House, where the it rolls off into, you know, these other several rooms or whatever it is. And of course, you know, there's some critics that are going to automatically say, well, yeah, if he's talking 50 years later, he's, you know, he's probably senile by then. Who knows?
Right. Who knows what's going on.
That's exactly.
You can't prove it. The distance in time would call it into question alone. That's
exactly right.
It could have happened that way, but it's a hard source to pin an entire theory on. There's also the statement from Oliver Cowdery, I believe, where he's describing papyri, and he talks about black ink and red ink. What would that be about? Is that because we don't? That's not in any of the papyri that we still have, right? We don't have.
Not that I know of. Again, that would be Rhodes and Gee that have studied these things a lot more than I have. And I've talked to Gee about some of the red print and stuff, and he's talked a little bit about. I can't remember if he called them titles or chapter headings or something. I can't remember exactly what he said. But we don't really have that much. We have a little bit of red stuff on some of the papyri, and don't ask me which ones because I couldn't give you the JSP number there. But there are some pictures, and I think if you look at that book that Rhodes just, and you probably have.
Brand new. I only got this one.
Okay,
so.
You're going to have to get a review copy of that.
Yeah.
But he's got some pictures in there, and I can't remember if he's got the... By the way, he has some Kirtland Egyptian stuff in there, but it's just the Egyptian. Okay, it's just the hieratic stuff. And so, which is good. I mean, he's taking care of all of that. But, so, I guess my point is this. If you want to just take it at face value and look at these documents, and if it tells you... that Occam's razor says that the simplest explanations is probably the truth, then you're going to have a false prophet there, if that's the road you want to go down. Personally, I think they're more complicated than that, and I know the critics don't like that. They don't like it when you complicate the thing, because then, you know, you have to... then you get away from that simplest explanation.
Right.
So, but I've looked at these documents enough to see that there's no one easy explanation for them. There's no one theory that I can see yet that explains all of the evidence that we have in our possession right now.
Something interesting that you bring up in your book, too, is that Abraham 5, which is the last chapter in our canonized book of Abraham, just kind of ends abruptly. And
it does.
It seems that there would be more. And you have found some evidence in reminiscences that there may have been more to the text.
Can you
talk about that?
Yes. Somebody like William West or some of the, even Oliver Cowdery, some of the statements that we're getting indicate that it was either in Joseph Smith's thoughts that he was saying, look, there's more material here, or he had dictated it and we've lost all that material. But he's talking about all these other things with Joseph, whether he got to the book of Joseph or not, I don't know. He's talking about the gathering of Israel. He's talking, you know, the Godhead, all this kind of stuff, none of which we have in the book of Abraham. And I'm going, well, why is he talking about the book of Abraham with the context of these topics? You know, does that mean that this material was in there and he wanted to get it out, or he was thinking about it? Or
maybe people even conflated things that he had...
That's possible.
The book of Moses and the book of Abraham. The book of Moses came out of the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible.
Yes.
And there are some things in there that kind of match up with some of the descriptions that people gave of what they said the book of Abraham was saying. So I think, I mean, even that's a possibility. But
there's a possible conflation.
But the fact
there is,
we also have an account of someone saying that they sat down and read the book of Abraham, and it took, I think, 2 hours.
Yeah. That's the Anson
call.
Yeah.
But when we sit down and read it, we could probably get through it in 30 minutes, 45 minutes.
Yeah, something
so
like that.
So unless they're really slow readers, it would seem that they at least maybe did have some more stuff that we just don't have now.
Yeah, that's so possible to me. It does stop so abruptly. And Joseph Smith made a promise in the Times and Seasons, said, I got more, I want to give you more.
What year was that?
That was in 1843.
So he had one more year to go.
Yeah,
so he
didn't, that's right.
He
but
didn't
he never
get around
he
to
never
it.
Got around to getting that out. But he did say... It's an editorial or something like that in the Times and Seasons. It says, Joseph Smith has promised us more of the book of Abraham. And it was in 1843 and never happened.
This concludes part one of our two-part interview with Professor Brian Hoglett of BYU. In the next episode, we'll talk more about his new book, A Textual History of the Book of Abraham. We'll discuss how the Book of Abraham became part of the LDS canon of Scripture, talk about some of the doctrinal and devotional elements of the text, and address some of the criticisms made about the book. Thanks again for listening to the FAIR Podcast. As always, questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. Walk like an Egyptian.